Paul Charles is the man here in front of me because he's possibly the most sort of, I'd say the black book, Paul, with you. A very impressive contact list in your phone. And over the weekend, you may have plans to meet up with friends and family, and no doubt you'll have a great time. But this guy here could be hanging out with Elvis Costello, Ray Davies, Tom Waits, Van Morrison. You are involved in their lives in a big way in terms of agent and touring and all the rest of it, etc. You're basically an author and an agent to the stars, and you've worked with the legendary artists in the music business over the years, and you've drawn upon your life experience from that and extensive knowledge of the music scene for a story and plot of your new novel, The Last Dance. Can I just say, The Last Dance by Paul Charles, with the Playboy show band on the cover, it's been 10 years on the go and a few years up on a shelf with nothing happening. Would I be right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I started it in 2002, and it's a project I wanted to do with, again, with a passion, because I grew up in Ulster and Marafelt around this period, and I kind of had this idea for this story, which is basically, it's a love story between these two characters, a guy called Martin Dean and Hannah Hutchinson. And they're kind of their school friends who grow up to become more as they're attracted to each other. And his backdrop is he writes songs. He joins a show band called the Playboys. And she heads off to Queen's University to kind of to get her education. So really it's a story of them and their life. And then I use the show band story because that was the backdrop to my growing up.
Yeah, and the big difference here is he writes songs and he's in a show band.
Yes.
People in show bands didn't write songs.
Exactly, exactly.
Or certainly didn't perform the songs they might have written.
Yeah, and one of the main reasons he didn't write songs and one of the reasons why there's not a great legacy of show band records is because the show band managers and the ballroom owners kind of didn't want the bands taking time off to do sissy things like write songs and to go in the recording studio because it was nights when they weren't out packing the ballrooms.
Okay, you, outside of this book, you as Paul Charles, were 15 years of age managing a band. How does somebody at 15 years of age manage a band?
Well, it's very easy. When you're 15 years of age, you don't think you're only 15 years of age. And also, it was a mates thing. I hung out with a bunch of my mates. They were starting a group. I couldn't sing, as all my friends will tell you. And my dad didn't have a car that could drive the band and the equipment to gigs. So they were the two main ingredients how you could be in a band. So, but what I did have, though, was that a friend of mine, two doors down, was this guy called Dixie Kerr, and he played saxophone on a show band called The Breakaways. So I could go knock on his door and say, Dixie, would you do us a favour? Would you give us a couple of relief gigs for my wee band, The Blues by Five? And he would. And because of that, I really became the manager. And that's really how I started off in the music business.
Okay, but you also had civil engineering going on as well before you moved to London, didn't you?
No, I moved to London, and that was, I mean, I knew I wanted to go to London because of the music scene. You know, ironically, I thought I'd be able to see the Beatles, stuff like that, when I realised afterwards that long since gone. So I kind of, my ticket to London, if you want, was to kind of go to study to be a civil engineer. But at the same time, I was managing a band and I was also writing for music magazines.
Was that the same band?
One guy out of that band, one guy out of the Blues by Five, formed a Belfast band called Frup.
Frup,
exactly.
Frup! Oh my God! I can just see my reeling in the ears.
There you go.
Frup, you managed Frup.
I managed Frup, yes.
Frup was one of the first bands I have ever in my life gone up to. I went over to the guy and I just talked to a rock star and said to him, I bought your album, I said to the guy with hair.
Oh, so you're the person?
Yeah, with hair down to his feet. And he kind of said, hey, Vince, get over here. We got a guy. He's the guy who bought our album. Vince McCusker was
the guitarist,
And I remember I went to the gigs. This is very sad. I went to the gigs and I was starting off and whatever I was. And he used to dress as a priest or something. He'd say, I want you all to move up the front pews.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah. Steve McCusker, yeah.
And
he played keyboards and oboe and spit blood.
Future legends.
Future legends. Yeah, a classic.
With a really crap cover on it, by
yes.
the way.
Well, actually, Peter, the guy from the band.
I thought you were going to say you drew it.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
So, a guy from the band did that, didn't he? It was awful cover. Anyway, let's get back. Oh, that's amazing. Frup with two U's.
Well, that's, and two P's.
Oh, two P's, that's right. Yeah. Crikey. Okay, where was I? You've thrown me with that one. Oh, yeah, Asgard. I didn't know you were a manager. I didn't know they had a manager. Anyway, Asgard Agency in London. That was co-run by your business partner and friend, Paul Fenn. It was all at the start of the punky kind of thing. I don't know, 75, 76 maybe. Who were the acts you were dealing with back then? Were they difficult?
The first acts we had would have been kind of probably a Country Gazette from America. One of the first acts I took on was an American guy called George Hatcher. And he moved to London and he put together a blues band called the George Hatcher Band, released a record and 8 artists. And they were one of those great classic gigging bands. You put them on a stage and they would book themselves for you. The phone would ring the next day.
Yeah.
And I did a lot of work with them, got them a lot of gigs, and then the guy at the record label saw their date sheet was full, and so the date sheet of his new act was empty.
Right.
And he rang me up and said, look, I've got this new act I want you to look at. And the new act was the Buzzcocks.
The Buzzcocks, right, yeah.
And then so from the Buzzcocks we went to the Undertones.
And Human League and Gang of Four and the Stranglers. And then you went on to some of the big American names, which, you know, in one way, like, were so bigly established. They were very established. Jackson Brown, Ry Cooder, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Tom Waits, all the rest of it.
Yeah, Crosby, Stills and Nash, yeah.
Crosby, Stills and Nash, okay.
Yeah, I mean, again, and it's that one of the things, when you're starting off with myself and Paul Fenn, you're sitting in a room, you've got six telephones each, and you've got nobody, and the phone don't ring. And you're thinking, how can you get this started? You know, and he booked some venues and stuff. And then you get an act, like when we got the Buzzcocks, because we had the Buzzcocks, the Undertones
wanted to come.
And that's the way it works. Because we got Van Morrison, we could work with Van Morrison, we then were able to approach Jackson Brown's people. And then you get Jackson Brown, you get Crosby, Stills and Nash. Yeah. It's kind of a bit of that thing. And
now,
then,
Van, who's playing in Marley Park in Dublin next week, what was it like working with Van?
I loved working with Van. I thought he was a great, great man, you know, in terms of being a professional, very, very professional. And, you know, if the show's meant to start at 8 o'clock, he wants to start at 8 o'clock. He wants all the band to turn up on time. He wants all of that. He kind of come from a lot of the acts that I've worked with that are from that era, like Robert Plant, like Ray Davis.
Yeah.
They have a professionalism to them. They kind of came from a part of that show business whereby you still had to, you know, be polite. You still had to have manners. You still had to be professional and stuff. And I think that and you know what? The thing that's not known about Van is he has an amazing sense of humour. You know, just listen to Mechanical Bliss.
Right, but by the same token, he's the kind of guy who would walk off stage if the vibe wasn't right and you had to deal with that sometimes.
I've never seen that.
Right.
I have to say, no, I really do mean he was professional.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've never ever seen him walk off stage.
But let's face it, Van's the man, so there you are.
You do Astral Weeks, you can do whatever you want.
Well, not so much. I could even go further and say if you do his band in Street Choir, if you do St. Dominic's Preview, and if you do Moondance, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tom Waits is agent. People want to know about that. There's a rumour that you met him in a record store in LA and went out for a cup of tea.
Exactly, yes. I was trying to get Tom, trying to work with him for ages because like everybody else in Ireland, I was a major, major fan. And everybody, I'd ring up a manager who'd become an ex-manager, ring up an accountant, become an ex-accountant, and I couldn't get anywhere. And I was in LA on one of my visits and one of my favourite stops was Tower Records.
Yeah.
And it was this big display for the One from the Heart album he did with Chris Gayle. I saw it, I thought, oh God, great. And I went up to the wee girl behind the counter and said, have you any of those albums? There's none on the shelf, blah, blah. She goes, you won't believe this, but I've just sold the last copy of it and I sold it to Tom Waits himself. And don't look now, but he's standing right behind you. So I went up, introduced myself. Kathleen, his wife, was with him. We went out for a cup of tea and that's how I became his agent.
Right, okay. Tom Waits is agent. That's a pretty good claim to fame, all right. Ry Cooder and all the rest of it too. There's so many stories I could ask there. But I mean, in terms of the book, The Last Dance that you have, this is fiction, but come on, with all the stories and like, you know, driving around in transit vans of some of the world's most legendary bands, how much of the real deal is in here?
Well, there's a lot of real stuff. There's a lot of real show band stuff in there.
But is real show band stuff from the 50s, 60s, as opposed to anything 80s, 90s or
no, now. No. This kind of finishes at the 65, 60, when the show bands were at their peak, you know, and the kind of, you know, the Royal were massive. Like, wherever they played, there was as many people outside the venue as there were inside them, you know. And again, it was a wonderful thing. And it's funny you mentioned band and street choir, because whenever anybody asks me what would be the typical show band sound, I would say there's about six tracks on band and street choir, which is just pure.
So on that Van Morrison album, you're saying that Van had a show band thing.
The very first time we went to see Van was at the Rainbow Theatre in 1973. And I sat down in the seat and he came on stage and it was just incredible. And I was thinking, my God, he's only gone and formed his own bleeding Irish show band.
Yeah.
know, because it was just, and it was that kind of joyous, melodic, hypnotic sound that the show bands had, you know, and that also that show band thing of, you know, kind of like the band leader or the singer would kind of encourage the musicians during the song. They kind of be shouting, we think, come on, bring it up, bring it, you know, with all that kind of stuff. He was doing all of that as well, you know.
When you see what happens these days, like in a few weeks' time, Lady Gaga will bring this extravaganza to the Aviva. We had Madonna doing it recently. We have MCD doing the hugest gigs. We have U2 and the 360s and all that. You're not involved or were ever involved on that level, were you? I'm probably delighted you weren't.
Yeah, no, I would pay not to be involved. I mean, my favourite concerts in Dublin are from the days in the stadium was Ry Cooder and Loudon Wainwright and Kitten and McGarrigle and all of them.
I remember trying to get into a gig there once, you know, you can't get in. That's another story altogether.
Exactly,
I don't blame you. Chuck Berry. I could talk to about so many people, but I mean, you've tangled with the legendary Chuck, a difficult man.
Well, a difficult man, but I think he had justification for being difficult.
He was ripped off of everything.
And that was the
thing. Really was.
He was ripped off badly, so his rules on the road were based on have been taken advantage of on the road for all the years of his life. So he would contract for a 50-minute set, and he would come off after 49 minutes and 30 seconds.
And the band, there has to be a band on the bill who could play three chords, he got paid before he went on.
Yeah, and if you wanted one encore, you paid extra. If he asked for a Fender Twin Reverb amplifier and it was a Fender Twin without the reverb, that's fine, man. I'll play through it, but you're going to have to pay extra for kind of having to endure inferior equipment.
Right, indeed. This is a really corny one, but here it goes. If I throw it at you real fast, you won't get it too bad. Desert Island one disc. Have you got one?
Single or album?
So, I did say disc. Yeah, you're right. Single.
A single would have to be...
Oh, God, I hope you get the right answer, because I've got something lined up here. It better be this.
Here Comes the Sun.
Damn! Oh, Here Comes the Sun. I played that already at the program.
Oh, did you? All right, there you go. Right.
That's amazing. Well, see, I know you like Ray, because I was talking to you last year about Ray Davies, so might as well. Did you see him doing this on Sunday night?
I saw him doing Waterloo Sunset.
Stepping out of the car. Yeah. I have a 9-year-old who said, I have one direction. Oh, no, there's just some old guy getting out of a car. Waterloo Sunset. Can't really be baiting, can it? And the only reason you didn't pick that because he's one of yours.
Yes, but it is a classic. You were 100% right.
Okay, fair enough. It's bizarre you picked a Beatles
song. What would you pick?
I'd pick Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles.
Oh, okay.
I'd have to really, Or maybe Sometimes by My Bloody Valentine.
Well, see, that's the problem. You kind of...
Yeah, suddenly you have 5,000. What was I going to say to you? The Beatles, by the way, just on the subject of the Beatles. Then you did meet them, and all sorts of strange... Just let's go through... By the way, we're talking to Paul Charles here, who is the author of the book that's out at the moment called The Last Dance. It is about the Playboys from Castlemartin, show band that is, the 11th of 765 most famous show bands in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the hooks for the book. I mean, my logic is, as well as being the story of Hannah and Martin, is if this show band really were the 11th best band in Ireland at that point, then how come after all these years later they've been written out of the history books? What did they do, or what did Martin Dean do that resulted in them being kind of, you know, disappearing?
Well, was his relationship with the girl who went to Belfast, or was it the fact that he wrote songs and you can't do that? A lot more besides,
yes, yeah. Involves Eurovision.
Right, okay, fair enough, exactly. Yeah. Okay, well, let's just get back to the Beatles then. You met them all in various... Well, you didn't meet John, did you?
I didn't meet John, no. I saw him at the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. He was there with Yoko, and he was doing a performance. And that was the only time I ever saw him live.
Okay, now you a good connection with Elvis Costello, and that would have been how you met George Harrison.
Yeah, I mean, at the Albert Hall, George Harrison was working at night, during the day with Jim Keltner, who was playing with Elvis at the time, one of the best drummers in the world, if not the best drummer in the world. And during the daytime, he was working with George on new records, so he brought George down to the gig, and, you know, we got introduced, you know, and he was very, very sweet and gracious man.
And you were able to talk to him about Waiting on You All. Now, this gets into very big detail in terms of all things must pass, his solo album after the Beatles. Yeah. But there was a great little story about Waiting on You All with that, wasn't
it? Well, again, it was, you know, the lyrics that were sang on the record weren't...
Written down
on the lyric sheet, you know.
And he had no comment to make about why.
Yeah.
Also, by the way, Elvis Costello, he wrote an awful lot of stuff, everything from So Like Candy to Veronica, great stuff, with Paul McCartney. Are you responsible for introducing Elvis to Paul McCartney?
Well, yeah, Paul McCartney was managed by a guy who used to be the publicist for Frupp, a guy called Richard Ogden, and he became the manager, and I knew him very, very well. And he rang up and said, look, I'm looking for young songwriters to put Paul with, to get into the next part of his career. And I said, there's only one person you should put him in touch with, and that's Elvis Costello. Liverpool background, great, great wordsmith, great ear for melodies. It'll be perfect, you know. So.
And it was. It was a fruitful thing.
Yeah,
and they did a bunch of stuff together.
They did quite a bit for both the records, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. Now, just the other Beatle then, the final one, is Ringo. Tanita Tickerham and Ringo and you.
Yes.
You were Tanita Tickerham.
In Monica, and she was there for an award, and it's one of those award ceremonies whereby you get an award if you turn up.
Yeah.
Equally, if you don't turn up, you don't get the award. Yeah. But anyway, so I'm standing there talking with Tanita, waiting for her to go and do her rehearsal spot. This guy comes up to us, says, look, and it turns out to be Ringo, look, if I go back home, having not had my photograph taken with Tanita, my daughters will kill me. So would you mind? So We took a shot, and that's how we met Ringo, right. Who again was a really, really wonderful man. Is a wonderful man.
Right, indeed. Yeah, Tanita Tick. I'm just trying to think about it. It's a twist in my sobriety.
Twist in my sobriety. Yes.
Whatever happened to her? Where is she these
days? Good tradition. She's got a record coming out. I don't work with her anymore. She's got a record coming out later on this month, I think.
Really? You know. Yeah, there's a question here at 51552. Have you ever met old Grumpy Shoes Eric Clapton?
Yes, and he wasn't.
Of course, you're going to say all the right things. Well, I've met him too, and he is a bit of a grumpy.
Right?
Actually.
No, well, I met. You know, again, I don't work with him. I've never worked with him, but I've met him, and you know, I thought he was very charming.
He needs to lighten up a bit, though. He sees himself as some kind of a I don't know what the word is, a musicologist, archaeologist for the blues people that he. You know, you're looking at me as though I've got two heads.
Right, right.
An archivist for the whole thing, and that they need to get the kind of praise they deserve, having ripped them off for years, Eric, by the way. I'm not wrong. Okay, let's move on then to something else. Is the book autobiographical?
There's bits of me in it. Martin Dean is kind of modelled but not copied from one of the all-time great Irish show band heads, a guy called Billy Brown. Who sang with the Fresh Men and did an arrangement. And another of my pet theories is that Billy Brown in a different generation with a different record
no
company
question.
Would have been as big as Elton John or Van. I mean, he's one of the most talented people I've
if
ever seen.
If the doors that were closed in front of him had been opened, i.e., for instance, a classic example would probably be people like Neil Sedaka or Carole King, after writing brilliant songs for everybody, said, what the hell, let's just do our own.
Yeah,
sing
yeah,
a song
yeah. No,
thing.
Totally.
And she brings out an album called Tapestry and it sells 20 million copies.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I remember I was at the Acadian Ballroom in Portrush once to see the Fresh Men. And just a very brief backstory is that the show bands really weren't what the ballrooms were about. The ballrooms, the main event was boys meeting girls and girls meeting boys, right?
Yeah.
And so all of this would all go on, all the dancing, all the chatting would all go on to a backdrop of the Irish show bands. This was all going on the stage, right? So there's this one night, and I say it's the Fresh Men, and you know it's packed to the rafters as usual. Everybody's dancing, everybody's tripping over each other's toes, and Billy Brown steps up to the microphone and sings "When Smoke Gets in Your Eyes." And I swear to you, the entire ballroom froze on their feet and just were glued. They didn't know why they were doing it. It was like something instinctive, was something inside of their psyche or whatever. But they just, this guy's power as a performer just stopped everybody dead in their tracks. It was incredible to see.
Okay, in terms of the moving around, though, it was a time when the jive gave away to the twist and all the rest of it. But the slow dance, the lurch, or going over to Ask Me Sister, I'm Sweating, all that stuff is part of what it all is. And you were part of all of that.
Oh, yeah, no, totally, totally. And also to know the games, the game really was to ask for the last dance.
Yeah.
And you had to ask for the last dance early enough that if you were turned down, you could then go and ask your other favourite girl for the last dance. And if you got the last dance, it means you got to walk.
And there'd be an awful
home.
Lot of political and kind of religious finger wagging as well. And Irish wasn't, they weren't really as chaste as some people would like you to believe if you were watching Reel in the Ears or something. Behind the scenes, things were happening, weren't they?
Oh, totally. Because that was the main event. You know, there was no drink, there was no drugs. It was really just, you know, this new young generation, the first post-war generation, getting to know each other in all senses of the word.
If you went around other than in the north, if you came to the 26 counties in much at all, would you have seen the priests there separating people for the lurch dance, the last one?
Well, a lot of that was going on, and the priests would probably well, actually, no, I was going to say they probably had more of an impact here than they would in the north. But no, they had it in the north as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, they would have it that, you know, the kind of, they would have their own dances, right? And the bands wouldn't get, you know, anything other than what they decided to give them. You know, it wasn't really treated as a commercial enterprise. It was treated as you're doing this for, you know, a higher authority, you know, and expected to.
Do you know when Geldof comes out as a rock band in 77 or whatever, and he jumps on the punk bandwagon, or was put on the punk bandwagon, whatever it happened to be, and he might as well ride it for all it's worth, etc. He has to give out about every single institution and every single thing. So one of the things he derided and said, my God, we got to rid this country of these horrible show bands. I'm sure you can understand that attitude. By the same token, though, it's unfair.
I think Bob just likes to have a go at something.
All right, well, let's leave Bob out of it. Let's leave other people attention. Who might be seem to be more level-headed.
No, I think it's you know, the great show bands were brilliant show bands. You know, I mean, Rory came from a show band.
Oh, yeah.
Van came from a show band. Tiger Taylor, Henry McCulloch. There were so many great people come out of the show bands. The problem of the show bands was original material, was original records, you know. But on stage, a great show band on form on a night. It was just something to behold, Dave. It was so, so beautiful. It was magic. Mm. It was what would inspire you.
And there really were over 700.
It was 763, I think, at that point.
And some of the bigger ones could be getting 2,000 and 3,000 people a night, wherever.
Yeah, and sometimes more. I mean, I remember the great Jamaican told me this story. One of the first professional gigs he did was promote the Royal Show Band at the Ulster Hall in Belfast. Yeah. And at that point, he was also a teacher. And he made more money that night than he made in an entire year as a teacher.
And Aiken Promotion still going very strong with Peter with all the big gigs as well.
And doing phenomenally well.
Indeed, yeah. Okay, so almost 20 years as a writer, 40 years in the music business. Do you have a preference? I mean, which is giving you the most satisfaction?
You know what? I love doing both. And I think at this stage, they both help each other. They both feed off each other. It's such a buzz. I mean, when you go to that space, as you know yourself, when you're writing, it's the best buzz that there is. It's great,
Tom Waits, I saw whatever it was about 2 years ago, was it, in the huge big tent, which really worked well in the Prince Park. He was like, you kind of think, oh my god, I don't know if he's going to still be able to do it. He was absolutely brilliant. Is he still, how's he doing?
He's doing great. I mean, I think the last record,
the Bad as Me record,
might possibly be his best record. Yeah. Again, in a career that long, that's an incredible thing to be even considering.
Indeed, absolutely.
He's such a powerful, powerful writer.
Yeah.
And a brilliant. And again, he won't do it the way you think he's going to do it, but he still makes it work.
Yeah.
But it works. It works so brilliantly.
It's funny, there's a book out at the moment. I spoke to Dylan Jones the other day from GQ. He's got the book about that 5 minutes on Top of the Pops when David Bowie did his thing in 1972. And he's got like 400 pages out of just that 5 minutes. And I've got two. Oddly enough, I remember ranting about this. Now you can say, oh yeah, whatever. But Adele doing Someone Like You on, what do you call it? Jill Talent. On Jill Talent. About 4 months before the actual album came out. And I was ringing the record company every day looking for the thing. Now I know that sounds whatever, but I just thought it was the most amazing thing. But 40 years before that or whatever, Tom Waits doing Tom Trobert's Blues on the Olga Whistle Test.
All right.
I was spellbound.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't believe that, like, this was what, about his second album? I hadn't even heard the first one.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I went back and got everything and been a fan.
But there's that, the Roy Orbison TV special?
Yeah.
White Nights or whatever it was called, right? There's a spot, and there's Elvis Costello, there's Bruce Springsteen, there's Jackson Browne, there's Jennifer Warrens, there's Bonnie Raitt, all in this band, right? Right. And Tom takes this organ solo. And everybody in the band are going, what was that?
Yeah.
Because it was just, he was on a different planet. But it worked. It was like so soulful, it worked.
I remember he did about 5 nights in the Olympia in Dublin. I went to Beep, to about 2 hours. My car broke down halfway. And we had to walk. We hitched for about 15 minutes. Nobody gave us a lift. And we got to the gig. And every single instrument he played on the stage seems to be like a found instrument.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It was
like
this bizarre, like gourd trees and weird stuff.
Yeah,
And it was brilliant.
No, totally. Yeah.
All right, well, look, I'll tell you, there's a question here. We're talking to Paul Charles, by the way. And the question here says, is there anyone that you haven't met that you wished you had? You met me, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, there you go. After that, it's all downhill.
It is,
Not really, no. I mean, obviously, there are people that I've been fans of from afar that I've never worked with. But and it's good to have that, I think. It's good to have this, this kind of passion that keeps you interested in doing what you're doing, and it shouldn't all be about who you're working
with. What about the other Elvis? I mean, he was huge when you were doing this show band stuff in the 50s and 60s. Have you ever met him?
And Elvis Presley?
Yeah.
No, before my time.
Before your time. This is a book about the 50s and 60s, by the way. All right, well, I can tell you what, it's called The Last Dance. It's by Paul Charles, published by New Island Fiction at just under 15 euro or 15 quid, I'm not sure which.
And, euro.
Euro, okay, fair enough. And you can check it out at paulcharlesbooks.com. You can check out the whole thing there. Well done, Paul, and thank you very much indeed. So I think, would you agree with me in some ways? In fact, I think I was saying it on the programme the other week, that if you think of Ireland and all the music, etc., regardless of the great love you have for the show bands, that even like you two are just a tributary, but the Shannon is Van Morrison.
I would say definitely, without a doubt.
All right, Paul Charles, good man yourself. Here goes.
Thanks, my dear Dave.